Welcome to our second lecture in our Pastoring as Vocation class. In this lecture, we'll take a look again at some contemporary statistics on the state of pastors, and we'll examine the article, Thriving in Ministry, Exploring the Support Systems and Self-Care Practices of Experienced Pastors, by Bledsoe and Sederlund. After this, we'll take a good look at stress and also visit the idea of trauma. Here's a common temptation for pastors. Many pastors struggle with professionalizing their spiritual lives and failing to care for their own souls under God. Paul Tripp, who's a pastor and influential writer, wrote a book about this type of temptation in 2012 called Dangerous Calling, Confronting the Unique Challenges of Pastoral Ministry. Two-thirds of his book center on both the danger of losing your awe, or forgetting who God is, and the danger of arrival, forgetting who you are. I've included this title in our optional book section under the syllabus tab. Now, in addressing the items on the slide, more than half of pastors don't feel that seminary or Bible college prepared them adequately. Hopefully, we're providing helpful preparation for you here at CCU. 7 in 10 are without a close friend. Half have no consistent accountability. Almost 3/4, in Tripp's language, have lost their awe for God due to the notion that personal Bible reading has been discarded for sermon preparation. 1 in 5 have a surface prayer life. Almost half do not see the value in a Sabbath or feel that they don't have time to rest. And while it's encouraging that over 1/3 get adequate exercise, it's discouraging that 1 in 3 get no physical exercise at all. Finally, 85% of pastors have not taken a sabbatical or an extended period of time, translating into months usually, away from the daily functions of the church. The last one may be the most difficult, for each denomination has its own policy, if it has a policy at all. Here's another post-COVID statistic on feelings of loneliness and isolation among pastors. While feelings of loneliness and isolation have increased over the better part of a decade, pastors' feelings of support from those around them have decreased. In 2015, nearly 7 in 10 pastors said they frequently felt well supported by people close to them. However, by 2022, that number had shifted lower, while nearly all pastors today, 92%, say they feel supported to some extent, just 49% say they feel this frequently. And in the realm of support, taken together, the trajectory of pastors' relational well-being shows an increase in pastors' loneliness and isolation, as well as a wavering sense of being well supported by those around them. A course correction is needed. If you could look back on the past 3 months, do you feel that the people closest to you have been adequately supportive of you? And have you been deliberate to maintain these types of relationships in your life? Lastly, pastors are rarely, if ever, utilizing professional help services. When asked how often pastors seek help or guidance from professionals like a spiritual advisor, personal mentor, professional counselor, or therapist, and other support personnel, 65% of all pastors say they are utilizing none of the above. And if pastors' self-reports are true, that would make them half as likely as U.S. adults overall to be receiving professional mental health services, according to CDC data. The none of the above number is fairly significant here. Now let's take a look at a 2015 article entitled Thriving in Ministry, Exploring the Support Systems and Self-Care Practices of Experienced Pastors by T. Scott Bledsoe and Kimberly A. Sederlund. This is a qualitative study that was conducted with the goal of finding out the pastor's best care practices when it comes to personal self-care. The authors open with a warning about the challenge of pastoring. Quote, pastors are somehow expected to remain paragons of virtue despite the many demands that are placed on them. The job itself may appear to provide all the ingredients necessary for personal fulfillment, yet 4 times as many pastors leave the profession within the first 5 years on the job than those who served 40 years ago, unquote. Yet with a challenge is a remedy, as the authors follow up by stating, quote, to sustain job satisfaction and minimize risk for burnout, clergy must promote self-care and maintain adequate systems of support in both their professional and personal lives, unquote. Thus, the article engages and says, quote, the unique insights provided may be beneficial to newer clergy or to those contemplating a clerical vocation, unquote. To start, the authors share that their research has concluded that both healthy support systems and effective self-care practices are two critical aspects of pastors feeling fueled up and fulfilled in their personal and vocational lives. Further, their studies show that, quote, physical, mental, and spiritual well-being are connected in terms of health practices, or that one can affect the two others in either helping them thrive or hindering their ability to thrive. Balance matters, as well as intention. However, the article states, quote, while clergy appear willing to seek out self-care resources, barriers such as long work days, inadequate rest, and the lack of clear boundary settings with others may deter them from benefiting from these practices. Other barriers include lack of awareness when psychological help is needed, fear of stigma, concerns about the qualification of the professionals to whom they have been referred, limited funds for counseling, and fears that confidentiality and therapy relationships will be broken. On the slide, you can see again the common sense conclusions of their research, that both support and self-care are important to the pastor's well-being, that it, quote, represents a fundamental aspect of long-term success in professional ministry that protects against negative health outcomes, unquote, and that these practices are efficacious as their reference to the statistic from the Smith research displays. Next, the authors offer tips on how to thrive in ministry. First, they define their terms, saying, quote, by definition, thriving is characterized by success or prosperity, and is used interchangeably with the term flourishing, to do very well, unquote. Further, the authors offer another definition, this time what they call a working definition of thriving. Quote, clergy who thrive are those who have obtained success or prosperity over the course of their careers through a variety of factors that may include a consistent desire to serve God and lead His people, the ability to reflect upon and learn from important experiences in ministry, and a focus on maintaining self-care and adequate support systems, unquote. And as an aid to help us thrive, they offer three guidelines to help ensure success in ministry. First, the identification of key characteristics of well-being in the areas of work satisfaction, meaning in life, personal growth, and work-family dynamics. As we're seeing, having an awareness of the need for self-care is the first and one of the bigger steps towards achieving efficacious self-care. Second, factors that facilitate and hinder well-being, including characteristics such as church size, fit between pastor and congregation, relationships, and denominational factors. I think this falls into the awareness category as well. We must be cognizant and realistic with the conditions in which we find ourselves and make the necessary adjustments as time goes forward. Something as strategic as hiring more staff as a church grows is a good discipline, or taking a vacation after a particularly difficult season in ministry are both examples of promoting self-care. And third, and here's another example of awareness, how the well-being of clergy change over a lifespan, specifically older versus younger ministers. This is a more long-term strategic goal for self-care and one that can be often overlooked, as to be honest, time passes so quickly. For example, if a pastor thinks that the 60-year-old mark is the place to transition to the next generation of leadership, the planning, or at least the praying phase of this should begin quite earlier, in my opinion. I'd say at least 10 years earlier. But to be honest, what 50-year-old in their prime and in the middle of a busy ministry is concretely thinking about passing the baton? It's cliche, but if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. Finally, Bledsoe and Sutherland offer four specific helps to fulfilling self-care: support systems, self-care practices, navigating through times of doubt, and promoting balance and self-awareness. First, support systems, which include mentors early on, where mentors can see developing leadership gifts in young people and encourage them, along with relational support, peer support, and spousal support. I have to say that along with friends who share my vocation, my wife has been the biggest source of support for me over the years. If you're part of a denomination, they may offer a wide range of support resources. And church members, those whom you trust, who can offer not only an outside godly, non-professional point of view, but can help take your mind off your vocation. Finally, more formal options, such as professional help, therapy, or personal growth, ongoing self-study, and continuing education. In the internet age, I found the latter to be quite helpful, and as a side note to this topic, I'd encourage you to be a lifelong learner. Second, self-care practices, such as daily physical and spiritual rituals, not to mention emotional and intellectual. It's common sense, but I'm relentless in my consistent devotional time, my physical maintenance time, and it helps as I grow as I age. And I've even carved out time for reading for pleasure, and history is my favorite, which helps me intellectually. Third, navigating through times of doubt. Rather than ignore these real experiences, feel condemned about their existence, or pretend they don't exist, examining and challenging negative thoughts and uncertainty with both the Holy Spirit and a faithful cloud of accountability is so helpful. Fourth, and we've heard these two before, promoting balance and self-awareness. Know your limits by creating self-borders. For example, I'm an introvert, so I know that being around people is draining, and thus I need time alone in order to recharge and again be helpful to others. Conversely, know the limits of others and cultivate faithfulness to the Lord and to your vocation, and find joy in the work. When you're called, the latter is much easier, but there are times of struggle in any pastor's life when it's a ministry of obedience and suffering rather than one of joy and fulfillment. Here is some information and statistics about the differing triggers for stress. So, stress. First, how would you define it? Take a second and ponder this question. After you're done, you can see a simple description of what defines the term. As you can see, stress is both multifaceted and can come at you from multiple directions. And what are the causes of stress in your life at the moment? Take a second and think about it. Here, the slide states that it's, quote, any event that has a significant amount of emotional power sufficient enough to overwhelm a person's or group's ability to cope, unquote. As I've had some training in critical incident stress management, one of the ways that they describe the journey through post-traumatic stress disorder is by having the patient understand that their reaction to stress and trauma are not the biggest challenge, but understanding that trauma produces common reactions in normal people to highly abnormal events. Let's take a look at four different types of stressors in the next four slides: micro, meso, exo, and macro system stressors. First, the causes of stress in the inner person, ourselves. It's worthy to note that all of these behaviors are symptoms or habits and thus can be course corrected. They include an absence of the discipline of daily prayer time, suppressed emotions. I love the statement, if you don't say it straight, you'll show it crooked. Hypervigilance, being busier than God rather than trusting in Him. Personal insecurities, inadequate preparation. Thankfully, the passion of our calling would help with this. Life cycle issues, lack of people to confide in, which is a handmaiden to feeling lonely, physiological limitations or health issues. Understanding our limits and proceeding accordingly is so helpful here. And finally, unresolved personal issues. With this last point, transparency and accountability with those whom you trust is vital, and you have to be humble enough to receive what they see in you. Along with this, later in the course, I'll acquaint you with what's known as adverse childhood experiences, which educates us on identifying the trauma we suffer as children. This tool can be helpful for us, as it can be for those whom we serve that have suffered this kind of trauma. Second, the meso system, which is family. Some of the challenges here include marriage and family pressures. While all families experience both positive and negative experiences, it's important to note that a pastor's life is unique to itself and has its own set of potential pitfalls. Family crisis or health issues. Not only with our own nuclear family, but now with the constant connection through social media, we bear the burden of both our extended family and friends whom we don't usually see. The 4 points of homework, extracurricular activities, time intrusions, frequent interruptions, irregular days off, and emotional drain speak to a need to not only cultivate personal balance, but family balance as well. And finally, financial pressures, of which pastors face a unique environment in the not-for-profit by faith world, and the cultural emphasis upon being a consumer of your stuff rather than being a steward of God's stuff, and the reality that pastors work most holidays, Easter, Christmas, Thanksgiving, and often New Year's Day. Third, the exosystem, or the stresses of ministry. The first three lean more toward the organizational bent, for one not serving according to giftedness can be discerned through a simple organizational chart. Organizationally, the pastor find themselves enveloped in multiple role demands. Pastors might have several hundred different demands, and more often than not, they jump from the sacred to the secular in the bat of an eye. Ministry can also be crisis-oriented, and coupled with that is the fact that pastors tend to see more negative than the average person. And as I've mentioned in my blacksmith metaphor, quite often we indirectly absorb the negative which God seeks to purge from those whom we serve. Finally, the pastor's schedule is very fluid and can be long and irregular at times, and they seem to have their work with them wherever they may find themselves. My wife once commented that she not only enjoyed her work as a CAT scan operator at her hospital, but she liked the fact that when she left the building, she left the entirety of her job behind. Not so much for pastors. Finally, pastors can suffer compassion fatigue, which we'll look at in another lecture. If you add this exosystem alone up, the potential for burnout is always there. Finally, the macro system stressors, or the congregation. While there's so much more to be said in praise of those whom we serve, the notion of stress is still existent when some of these issues show themselves in the body. For example, idealization, or the expectation the pastor may have of others, and conversely, the expectations that others in the congregation may have of the pastor. We're going to read Pooler's role identity theory, which will unpack this a bit. And much like the two sides of idealization, congregants can transfer their unresolved issues onto the pastor. And in like fashion, the pastor can do the same to individual congregants. Having suffered through a painful divorce in my late 20s, a few years later, I encountered a gentleman experiencing the end of his marriage. In our conversations, the Holy Spirit revealed to me, and it was through this gentleman's observation, that I was transferring my hurt onto him, and I not only immediately repented, but made the proper course correction. Congregants can also unwittingly intrude on our lives, but to that I would say it's incumbent upon the pastor to not only set boundaries, but to communicate them with the body. I found that since I've formed friendships with so many in our church, that they reflexively are protective of my wife and me. You'll always have a measure of the trio of ingratitude, criticism, and undue influence from others. It's just human nature, and the pastor must learn how to handle these with grace, and occasionally handle them with justice. Finally, as pastors care about folks, we're quite susceptible to people-pleasing pressures, whether that come from ourselves or from others who may seek to exploit that trait. Now let's look at three aspects of the physiology of stress: the existence of cortisol, adrenaline, and noradrenaline. Firstly, cortisol. I won't read the text on the slide verbatim, but one salient point of cortisol is that it affects us physically. In this case, it increases blood pressure and blood sugar levels. So, scientifically, we learn that stress induces the production of cortisol in our bodies. Secondly, adrenaline is released when one is in the presence of perceived danger. As you can see, the release of adrenaline in our system also affects us physically. The hormone boosts the supply of oxygen and energy-giving glucose to our brain and muscles, and it plays a central role in the short-term stress reaction. Finally, there's noradrenaline. This chemical affects the brain, as it not only affects parts of the brain where attention and responding actions are controlled, but it also affects our memory. Here's what I think is a helpful thought from Carrie Newhoff. Quote, "Stress is a good bad word. Our culture hates stress, yet thrives on it. As a result, the pullback towards stress is almost gravitational. Stress is the badge of honor in the hamster wheel life everybody's living." Unquote. So, with an understanding of the science of stress, how can we mitigate its effects upon our lives and thus practice healthy self-care? The next couple of slides address that with 8 tips, all of which begin with the letter R. The first two are responsibility and reflection. Be responsible to know your priorities and goals, and be responsible to create a policy that will enable you to fulfill them. And remember that no is not a Christian curse word. If it's said in honesty and humility, it's truth. To this point, Carrie Newhoff says, quote, "Many leaders default to yes, and in the process lose focus on their primary work. Plus, for you and others who naturally want to please the people you serve, saying no might seem to be a challenging or insensitive emotion. And along with knowing what you're called to do, know the signs, both internal and external, when the margins in your life are being crowded, or when stress is taking territory and thus needs attention." The next two helps in managing stress are relaxation and relationships. In my opinion, both have become more difficult in the digital post-COVID world, as our communication technology hinders our ability to compartmentalize our lives. In other words, with my phone, I can be at the dinner table with my family, but my office is sitting right on the table next to me in the form of that phone. And I'm preaching to myself here. I need to remember that God chooses to use me, but in the end, He doesn't need me. His plans won't rise or fall on my presence, so I've learned to relax more. One aid to that is a deep relationship with Jesus, our great shepherd. Relationships are also tricky in the digital world. In fact, so many people live relationally through a computer screen, which is a reality of life, but not a habit that I'd like to wholly substitute for seeing people face to face. Despite that fact that so much of pastoring is relational, find people whom you trust, who you have an affinity for, and who you can be yourself around, and be diligent to keep and cultivate those relationships. Next, it's routines and refueling. Regarding a routine, we all have one. It's just incumbent upon us to incorporate and cultivate healthy and godly routines in our lives. I have a series of steadfast routines regarding my personal spiritual life, my diet, my physical health, and my emotional health. And I found that I'm able to apply the previous two R's in my life, relaxation and relationships, much easier in my day-to-day life if I treat them as healthy routines in which to embrace. For example, we walk our dog by the beach at least 5 times a week, giving my wife and I time together in a relaxing setting that includes physical exercise. Another H of routines is to allow someone to hold you accountable for their usage in your life. Do you have someone who holds you accountable to your time, your talent, and your treasure? Cliche, but quote, people don't do what you expect, they do what you inspect, unquote. Accountability is so very, very healthy for pastors. Refueling. In regard to this, I'd encourage you to be circumspect about the standard American diet and the general standard American way of life. In fact, I have a couple of videos in the course from doctors who specialize in nutrition and offer an alternative to some of the very bad habits and choices that are bound up in our culture. And as always, be a discipline of moderation. The final 2 points are retraining and recreation. As far as retraining, an ancient Greek stated that the only constant in life is change. And while that's a philosophical statement rather than a theological one, it's certainly practical. We must be flexible enough to understand that change is inevitable and be prepared to adjust accordingly. And in regard to recreation, be intentional to take time away from the pressures of pastoring to enjoy the life that God has given you. Here's some more science regarding the chemistry of stress. In this instance, the notion and practice of healthy sleep practices and how efficacious they can be to our overall general welfare. I think we all know the value of proper rest and how it literally can change our outlook on things, but the quote says it does much more. Quote, a good night's sleep may literally clear the mind. The brain's molecular waste disposal system is most active when we're sleeping. This adds to our understanding of the purpose of sleep and could inspire treatments for dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, and other neurological diseases linked to protein buildup in the brain, unquote. For some, the self-deprivation of sleep is a badge of honor. Don't buy it. Finally, a bit on trauma and vicarious traumatization in the next and final slide. First, take a second and think about how you'd define the term. Dictionary.com defines it as, quote, a deeply distressing or disturbing experience, unquote. Further, our slide states that, quote, psychological trauma is the unique individual experience of an event or enduring conditions in which the individual's ability to integrate his or her emotional experience is overwhelmed, or the individual experiences subjectively a threat to life, bodily integrity, or sanity, unquote. Thus, a traumatic event or situation creates psychological trauma when it overwhelms the individual's ability to cope and leaves that person in fear. The individual may feel emotionally, cognitively, and physically overwhelmed. The circumstances of the event commonly include abuse of power, betrayal of trust, entrapment, helplessness, pain, confusion, and/or loss. Trauma is most noticeably tied together with the acronym PTSD, or as I mentioned earlier, and a term with which you're familiar, post-traumatic stress disorder. According to the National Center for PTSD, about 6 of every 10 men and 5 of every 10 women experience at least one trauma in their lives. So, for the pastor, their immersion into the traumatic experiences of others, which often become long-term relational situations, and the trauma experienced in their own life can be a heavy burden to carry. That's the subject of our final slide. How would you define the term vicarious traumatization? Our slide states that it's, quote, the transformation that occurs within the trauma worker as a result of sympathetic engagement with clients' trauma experiences and their sequelae, a condition that is the consequence of a previous disease or injury. Vicarious traumatization includes listening to graphic descriptions of horrific events, bearing witness to people's cruelty to one another, and witnessing and participating in traumatic reenactments. To add to this, research compiled by the California Department of Criminal Justice concludes that vicarious trauma was first identified in the 1980s as the cost of caring. It's sometimes referred to as compassion fatigue. Symptoms can parallel those of PTSD, re-experiencing, numbness, avoidance, and personal arousal. Professionals working with survivors of trauma, such as sexual assault, report changes to how they see the world. For example, that the world is not just or safe. Professionals with previous trauma histories show significantly higher secondary trauma symptoms than those with no trauma histories. This information is sobering, but vital for us to be aware of. While I thank God that He helps us minister to these burdens, heal from these burdens, and keep these burdens from defining us, we must remember that we're still human, and both our humanity and our vocation places us in the bullseye of falling prey to vicarious traumatization. Be aware, be transparent, and be accountable. Should it occur, let others carry this weight with you. On that note, that concludes this lecture. May the Lord bless your service to Him, and may you cling ever so close to Him.